too, had met with Brown. He argued against the plan from the standpoint of its chances of success. But he admired the ailing man of 60, tall, gaunt, white-haired. Douglas was right. The plan would not work. The local militia, joined by 100 Marines under the command of Robert E. Lee, surrounded the insurgents. Although his men were dead or captured, John Brown refused to surrender. He barricaded himself in a small brick building near the gate of the armory. The troops battered down a door. A Marine lieutenant moved in and struck Brown with his sword. Wounded, sick, he was interrogated. W.E.B. Du Bois, in his book, John Brown, writes, "Picture the situation. An old and blood-bespattered man, half-dead from the wounds inflicted but a few hours before, a man lying in the cold and dirt, without sleep for 55 nerve-wrecking hours, without food for nearly as long, with the dead bodies of his two sons almost before his eyes, the piled corpses of his 7 slain comrades, near and afar, a wife and a bereaved family listening in vain, and a lost cause, the dream of a lifetime, lying dead in his heart. Lying there, interrogated by the governor of Virginia, Brown said, "You had better, all you people at the South, prepare yourselves for a settlement of this question. You may dispose of me very easily. I am nearly disposed of now. But this question is still to be settled. This Negro question, I mean. The end of that is not yet." Du Bois appraises Brown's action. "If his foray was the work of a handful of fanatics, led by a lunatic and repudiated by the slaves to a man, then the proper procedure would have been to ignore the incident, quietly punish the worst offenders, and either pardon the misguided leader or send him to an asylum, while insisting that the raid was too hopelessly and ridiculously small to accomplish anything. The state nevertheless spent $250,000 to punish the invaders, stationed from 1,000 to 3,000 soldiers in the vicinity, and threw the nation into turmoil." In John Brown's last written statement in prison, before he was hanged, he said, "I, John Brown, am quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood." Ralph Waldo Emerson, not an activist himself, said of the execution of John Brown, "He will make the gallows holy as the cross." Of the 22 men in John Brown's striking force, 5 were black. 2 of these were killed on the spot, 1 escaped, and 2 were hanged by the authorities. Before his execution, John Copeland wrote to his parents, "Remember that if I must die, I die in trying to liberate a few of my poor and oppressed people from my condition of servitude, which God in His holy writ has hurled His most bitter denunciations against. I am not terrified by the gallows. I imagine that I hear you and all of you, mother, father, sisters, and brothers, say, 'No, there is not a cause for which we, with less sorrow, could see you die.' Believe me when I tell you that though shut up in prison and under sentence of death, I have spent many more happy hours here, and I would almost as lief die now as at any time, for I feel that I am prepared to meet my Maker." John Brown was executed by the state of Virginia with the approval of the national government. It was the national government which, while weakly enforcing the law ending the slave trade, sternly enforced the laws providing for the return of fugitives to slavery. It was the national government that, in Andrew Jackson's administration, collaborated with the South to keep abolitionist literature out of the mails in the southern states. It was the Supreme Court of the United States that declared in 1857 that the slave Dred Scott could not sue for his freedom because he was not a person, but property. Such a national government would never accept an end to slavery by rebellion. It would end slavery only under conditions controlled by whites and only when required by the political and economic needs of the business elite of the North. It was Abraham Lincoln who combined perfectly the needs of business, the political ambition of the new Republican Party, and the rhetoric of humanitarianism. He would keep the abolition of slavery not at the top of his list of priorities, but close enough to the top so it could be pushed there temporarily by abolitionist pressures and by practical political advantage. Lincoln could skillfully blend the interests of the very rich and the interests of the black at a moment in history when these interests met. And he could link these two with a growing section of Americans, the white, up-and-coming, economically ambitious, politically active middle class. As Richard Hofstadter put it, thoroughly middle class in his ideas, he spoke for those millions of Americans who had begun their lives as hired workers, as farmhands, clerks, teachers, mechanics, flatboat men, and rail splitters, and had passed into the ranks of landed farmers, prosperous grocers, lawyers, merchants, physicians, and politicians. Lincoln could argue with lucidity and passion against slavery on moral grounds, while acting cautiously in practical politics. He believed that the institution of slavery is founded on injustice and bad policy, but that the promulgation of abolition doctrines tends to increase rather than abate its evils. Put against this, Frederick Douglass's statement on struggle, or Garrison's, "Sir, slavery will not be overthrown without excitement, a most tremendous excitement." Lincoln read the Constitution strictly to mean that Congress, because of the Tenth Amendment, reserving to the states powers not specifically given to the national government, could not constitutionally bar slavery in the states. When it was proposed to abolish slavery in the District of Columbia, which did not have the rights of a state, but was directly under the jurisdiction of Congress, Lincoln said this would be constitutional, but it should not be done unless the people in the district wanted it. Since most there were white, this killed the idea. As Hofstadter said of Lincoln's statement, it breathes the fire of an uncompromising insistence on moderation. Lincoln refused to denounce the fugitive slave law publicly. He wrote to a friend, "I confess, I hate to see the poor creatures hunted down, but I bite my lips and keep quiet." And when he did propose in 1849, as a congressman, a resolution to abolish slavery in the District of Columbia, he accompanied this with a section requiring local authorities to arrest and return fugitive slaves coming into Washington. This led Wendell Phillips, the Boston abolitionist, to refer to him years later as "that slave hound from Illinois." He opposed slavery, but could not see blacks as equals, so a constant theme in his approach was to free the slaves and to send them back to Africa. In his 1858 campaign in Illinois for the Senate against Stephen Douglas, Lincoln spoke differently depending on the views of his listeners, and also perhaps depending on how close it was to the election. Speaking in northern Illinois in July in Chicago, he said, "Let us discard all this quibbling about this man and the other man, this race and that race, and the other race being inferior, and therefore they must be placed in an inferior position. Let us discard all these things and unite as one people throughout this land until we shall once more stand up declaring that all men are created equal." 2 months later, in Charleston, in southern Illinois, Lincoln told his audience, "I will say then that I am not, nor have I ever been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races." Applause. "That I am not, nor have ever been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, not of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And inasmuch as they cannot so live, while they do remain together, there must be the position of superior and inferior. And I, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race." Behind the secession of the South from the Union, after Lincoln was elected president in the fall of 1860 as candidate of the new Republican Party, was a long series of policy clashes between North and South. The clash was not over slavery as a moral institution. Most Northerners did not care enough about slavery to make sacrifices for it, certainly not the sacrifice of war. It was not a clash of peoples. Most Northern whites were not economically favored, not politically powerful. Most Southern whites were poor farmers, not decision-makers, but of elites. The Northern elite wanted economic expansion, free land, free labor, a free market, a high protective tariff for manufacturers, a bank of the United States. The slave interests opposed all that. They saw Lincoln and the Republicans as making continuation of their pleasant and prosperous way of life impossible in the future. So, when Lincoln was elected, 7 Southern states seceded from the Union. Lincoln initiated hostilities by trying to repossess the federal base at Fort Sumter, South Carolina, and 4 more states seceded. The Confederacy was formed. The Civil War was on. Lincoln's first inaugural address in March 1861 was conciliatory toward the South and the seceded states. "I have no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. I believe I have no lawful right to do so, and I have no inclination to do so." And with the war 4 months on, when General John C. Fremont in Missouri declared martial law and said slaves of owners resisting the United States were to be free, Lincoln countermanded this order. He was anxious to hold in the Union the slave states of Maryland, Kentucky, Missouri, and Delaware. It was only as the war grew more bitter, the casualties mounted, desperation to win heightened, and the criticism of the abolitionists threatened to unravel the tattered coalition behind Lincoln, that he began to act against slavery. Hofstadter puts it this way: "Like a delicate barometer, he recorded the trend of pressures, and as the radical pressure increased, he moved toward the left." Wendell Phillips said that if Lincoln was able to grow, it is because we have watered him. Racism in the North was as entrenched as slavery in the South, and it would take the war to shake both. New York blacks could not vote unless they owned $250 in property, a qualification not applied to whites. A proposal to abolish this, put on the ballot in 1860, was defeated 2-1, although Lincoln carried New York by 50,000 votes. Frederick Douglass commented, "The black baby of Negro suffrage was thought too ugly to exhibit on so grand an occasion. The Negro was stowed away like some people put out of sight their deformed children when company comes." Wendell Phillips, with all his criticism of Lincoln, recognized the possibilities in his election. Speaking at the Tremont Temple in Boston the day after the election, Phillips said, "If the telegraph speaks truth, for the first time in our history, the slave has chosen a president of the United States. Not an abolitionist, hardly an anti-slavery man. Mr. Lincoln consents to represent an anti-slavery idea. A pawn on the political chessboard, his value is in his position. With fair effort, we may soon change him for a knight, bishop, or queen, and sweep the board." Applause. Conservatives in the Boston upper classes wanted reconciliation with the South. At one point, they stormed an abolitionist meeting at the same Tremont Temple shortly after Lincoln's election and asked that concessions be made to the South in the interests of commerce, manufactures, agriculture. The spirit of Congress, even after the war began, was shown in a resolution it passed in the summer of 1861, with only a few dissenting votes. "This war is not waged for any purpose of overthrowing or interfering with the rights of established institutions of those states, but to preserve the Union." the abolitionists stepped up their campaign. Emancipation petitions poured into Congress in 1861 and 1862. In May of that year, Wendell Phillips said, "Abraham Lincoln may not wish it. He cannot prevent it. The nation may not will it, but the nation cannot prevent it. I do not care what men want or wish. The Negro is the pebble in the cogwheel, and the machine cannot go on until you get him out." In July, Congress passed a Confiscation Act, which enabled the freeing of slaves of those fighting the Union. But this was not enforced by the Union's generals, and Lincoln ignored the non-enforcement. Garrison called Lincoln's policy stumbling, halting, prevaricating, irresolute, weak, besotted. And Phillips said Lincoln was a first-rate, second-rate man. An exchange of letters between Lincoln and Horace Greeley, editor of the New York Tribune, in August of 1862, gave Lincoln a chance to express his views. Greeley wrote, "Dear Sir, I do not intrude to tell you, for you must already know, that a great proportion of those who triumphed in your election are sorely disappointed and deeply pained by the policy you seem to be pursuing with regard to the slaves of rebels. We require of you, as the first servant of the Republic, charged especially and preeminently with this duty, that you execute the laws. We think you are strangely and disastrously remiss with regard to the emancipating provisions of the new Confiscation Act. We think you are unduly influenced by the counsels of certain politicians hailing from the border slave states." Greeley appealed to the practical need of winning the war. "We must have scouts, guides, spies, cooks, teamsters, diggers, and choppers from the blacks of the South, whether we allow them to fight for us or not. I entreat you to render a hearty and unequivocal obedience to the law of the land." Lincoln had already shown his attitude by his failure to countermand an order of one of his commanders, General Henry Halleck, who forbade fugitive Negroes to enter his army's lines. Now he replied to Greeley, "Dear Sir, I have not meant to leave anyone in doubt. My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could do it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because it helps to save this Union. And what I forbear because I do not believe it would be help to save the Union. I have here stated my purpose according to my view of official duty, and I intend no modification of my oft-expressed personal wish that all men everywhere could be free. Yours, A. Lincoln." So Lincoln distinguished between his personal wish and his official duty. When, in September 1862, Lincoln issued his preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, it was a military move, giving the South 4 months to stop rebelling, threatening to emancipate their slaves if they continued to fight, promising to leave slavery untouched in states that came over to the North. That on the first day of January, A.D. 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state or designated part of a state, the people whereof shall then be in rebellion against the United States, shall be then, thenceforward, and forever, free. Thus, when the Emancipation Proclamation was issued on January 1, 1863, it declared slaves free in those areas still fighting against the Union, which it listed very carefully, and said nothing about slaves behind Union lines. As Hofstadter put it, the Emancipation Proclamation had all the moral grandeur of a bill of lading. The London Spectator wrote concisely, The principle is not that a human being cannot justly own another, but that he cannot own him unless he is loyal to the United States. Limited as it was, the Emancipation Proclamation spurred anti-slavery forces. By the summer of 1864, 400,000 signatures asking legislation to end slavery had been gathered and sent to Congress, something unprecedented in the history of the country. That April, the Senate had adopted the 13th Amendment, declaring an end to slavery, and in January 1865, the House of Representatives followed. With the proclamation, the Union Army was open to blacks. And the more blacks entered the war, the more it appeared a war for their liberation. The more whites had to sacrifice, the more resentment there was, particularly among poor whites in the North, who were drafted by a law that allowed the rich to buy their way out of the draft for $300. And so the draft riots of 1863 took place, uprisings of angry whites in northern cities, their targets, not the rich far away, but the blacks near at hand. It was an orgy of death and violence. A black man in Detroit described what he saw, a mob with kegs of beer on wagons, armed with clubs and bricks, marching through the city, attacking black men, women, children. He heard one man say, "If we are got to be killed up for Negroes, then we will kill everyone in this town." The Civil War was one of the bloodiest in human history up to that time. 600,000 dead on both sides, in a population of 30 million. The equivalent in the United States of 1978 with a population of 250 million, of 5 million dead. As the battles became more intense, as the bodies piled up, as war fatigue grew, the existence of blacks in the South, 4 million of them, became more and more a hindrance to the South, and more an opportunity for the North. Du Bois in Black Reconstruction pointed this out. These slaves had enormous power in their hands. Simply by stopping work, they could threaten the Confederacy with starvation. By walking into the federal camps, they showed to doubting Northerners the easy possibility of using them thus, but by the same gesture depriving their enemies of their use in just these fields. It was this plain alternative that brought Lee's sudden surrender. Either the South must make terms with its slaves, free them, use them to fight the North, and thereafter no longer treat them as bondsmen, or they could surrender to the North with the assumption that the North, after the war, must help them to defend slavery as it had before. George Rowick, a sociologist and anthropologist, describes the development of blacks up to and into the Civil War. The slaves went from being frightened human beings, thrown among strange men, including fellow slaves who were not their kinsmen, and who did not speak their language or understand their customs and habits, to what W.E.B. Du Bois once described as the general strike, whereby hundreds of thousands of slaves deserted the plantations, destroying the South's ability to supply its army. Black women played an important part in the war, especially toward the end. Sojourner Truth, the legendary ex-slave who had been active in the women's rights movement, became recruiter of black troops for the Union Army, as did Josephine St. Pierre Ruffin of Boston. Harriet Tubman raided plantations, leading black and white troops, and in one expedition freed 750 slaves. Women moved with the colored regiments that grew as the Union Army marched through the South, helping their husbands, enduring terrible hardships on the long military treks in which many children died. They suffered the fate of soldiers, as in April 1864, when Confederate troops at Fort Pillow, Kentucky, massacred Union soldiers who had surrendered, black and white, along with women and children in an adjoining camp. It has been said that black acceptance of slavery is proved by the fact that during the Civil War, when there were opportunities for escape, most slaves stayed on the plantation. In fact, 500,000 ran away, about 1 in 5, a high proportion when one considers that there was great difficulty in knowing where to go and how to live. The owner of a large plantation in South Carolina and Georgia wrote in 1862, "This war has taught us the perfect impossibility of placing the least confidence in the Negro. In 2 numerous instances, those we esteem the most have been the first to desert us." That same year, a lieutenant in the Confederate Army and once mayor of Savannah, Georgia, wrote, "I deeply regret to learn that the Negroes still continue to desert to the enemy." A minister in Mississippi wrote in the fall of 1862, "On my arrival was surprised to hear that our Negroes stampeded to the Yankees last night, or rather a portion of them. I think every one, but with 1 or 2 exceptions, will go to the Yankees. Eliza and her family are certain to go. She does not conceal her thoughts, but plainly manifests her opinions by her conduct, insolent and insulting." And a Woman's Plantation Journal of January 1865. "The people are all idle on the plantations, most of them seeking their own pleasure. Many servants have proven faithful, others false and rebellious against all authority and restraint. Their condition is one of perfect anarchy and rebellion. They have placed themselves in perfect antagonism to their owners and to all government and control. Nearly all the house servants have left their homes, and from most of the plantations they have gone in a body." Also in 1865, a South Carolina planter wrote to the New York Tribune that, "The conduct of the Negro in the late crisis of our affairs has convinced me that we are all laboring under a delusion. I believed that these people were content, happy, and attached to their masters. But events and reflection have caused me to change these positions. If they were content, happy, and attached to their masters, why did they desert him in the moment of his need and flock to an enemy whom they did not know, and thus left their perhaps really good masters whom they did know from infancy?" Genovese notes that the war produced no general rising of slaves, but in Lafayette County, Mississippi, slaves responded to the Emancipation Proclamation by driving off their overseers and dividing the land and implements among themselves. Apfecker reports a conspiracy of Negroes in Arkansas in 1861 to kill their enslavers. In Kentucky that year, houses and barns were burned by Negroes, and in the city of Newcastle, slaves paraded through the city, singing political songs and shouting for Lincoln, according to newspaper accounts. After the Emancipation Proclamation, a Negro waiter in Richmond, Virginia, was arrested for leading a servile plot, while in Yazoo City, Mississippi, slaves burned the courthouse and 14 homes. There were special moments. Robert Smalls, later a South Carolina congressman, and other blacks took over a steamship, the Planter, and sailed it past the Confederate guns to deliver it to the Union Navy. Most slaves neither submitted nor rebelled. They continued to work, waiting to see what happened. When opportunity came, they left, often joining the Union Army. 200,000 blacks were in the Army and Navy, and 38,000 were killed. Historian James McPherson says, "Without their help, the North could not have won the war as soon as it did, and perhaps it could not have won at all." What happened to blacks in the Union Army and in the northern cities during the war gave some hint of how limited the emancipation would be, even with full victory over the Confederacy. Off-duty black soldiers were attacked in northern cities, as in Zanesville, Ohio, in February 1864, where cries were heard to "kill the nigger." Black soldiers were used for the heaviest and dirtiest work, digging trenches, hauling logs and cannon, loading ammunition, digging wells for white regiments. White privates received $13 a month. Negro privates received $10 a month. Late in the war, a black sergeant of the 3rd South Carolina Volunteers, William Walker, marched his company to his captain's tent and ordered them to stack arms and resign from the army as a protest against what he considered a breach of contract because of unequal pay. He was court-martialed and shot for mutiny. Finally, in June 1864, Congress passed a law granting equal pay to Negro soldiers. The Confederacy was desperate in the latter part of the war, and some of its leaders suggested the slaves, more and more an obstacle to their cause, be enlisted, used, and freed. After a number of military defeats, the Confederate Secretary of War, Judah Benjamin, wrote in late 1864 to a newspaper editor in Charleston, "It is well known that General Lee, who commands so largely the confidence of the people, is strongly in favor of our using the Negroes for defense and emancipating them, if necessary, for that purpose." One general, indignant, wrote, "If slaves will make good soldiers, our whole theory of slavery is wrong." By early 1865, the pressure had mounted, and in March, President Davis of the Confederacy signed a Negro Soldier Law, authorizing the enlistment of slaves as soldiers to be freed by consent of their owners and their state governments. But before it had any significant effect, the war was over. Former slaves, interviewed by the Federal Writers Project in the 30s, recalled the war's end. Susie Melton. "I was a young gal about 10 years old, and we done heard that Lincoln gonna turn the niggers free. Old Missus says there wasn't nothing to it. Then a Yankee soldier told someone in Williamsburg that Lincoln done signed the emancipation. Was winter time and mighty cold that night, but everybody commenced getting ready to leave. Didn't care nothing about Missus, was going to the Union lines, and all that night the niggers danced and sang right out in the cold. Next morning at daybreak we all started out with blankets and clothes and pots and pans and chickens piled on our backs, 'cause Missus said that we couldn't take no horses or carts. And as the sun come up over the trees, the niggers started to singin'. Son, you be here and I'll be gone. Son, you be here and I'll be gone. Son, you be here and I'll be gone. Bye-bye, don't grieve after me. Won't give you my place, not for yours. Bye-bye, don't grieve after me. 'Cause you be here, and I'll be gone." Anna Woods. "We wasn't there in Texas long when the soldiers marched in to tell us that we were free. I remembers one woman. She jumped on a barrel, and she shouted. She jumped off, and she shouted. She jumped back on again and shouted some more. She kept that up for a long time, just jumping on a barrel and back off again." Annie Mae Weathers said, "I remember hearing my pa say that when somebody came and hollered, 'You niggers is free at last,' say he just dropped his hoe and said in a queer voice, 'Thank God for that.'" The Federal Writers Project recorded an ex-slave named Fanny Berry. "Niggers shouting and clapping hands and singing, chillin' running all over the place, beating time and yelling, everybody happy. Show did some celebration. Run to the kitchen and shout in the window, 'Mammy, don't you cook no more. You's free. You's free.'" Many Negroes understood that their status after the war, whatever their situation legally, would depend on whether they owned the land they worked on or would be forced to be semi-slaves for others. In 1863, a North Carolina Negro wrote that, "If the strict law of right and justice is to be observed, the country around me is the entailed inheritance of the Americans of African descent, purchased by the invaluable labor of our ancestors through a life of tears and groans under the lash and yoke of tyranny." Abandoned plantations, however, were leased to former planters and to white men of the North. As one colored newspaper said, "The slaves were made serfs and chained to the soil. Such was the boasted freedom acquired by the colored man at the hands of the Yankee. Under congressional policy approved by Lincoln, the property confiscated during the war under the Confiscation Act of July 1862 would revert to the heirs of the Confederate owners. Dr. John Rock, a black physician in Boston, spoke at a meeting. "Why talk about compensating masters? Compensate them for what? What do we owe them? What does the slave owe them? What does society owe them? Compensate the master? It is the slave who ought to be compensated. The property of the South is by right the property of the slave." Some land was expropriated on grounds the taxes were delinquent and sold at auction, but only a few blacks could afford to buy this. In the South Carolina Sea Islands, out of 16,000 acres up for sale in March of 1863, freedmen who pooled their money were able to buy 2,000 acres, the rest being bought by northern investors and speculators. A freedman on the islands dictated a letter to a former teacher now in Philadelphia. "My dear young missus, do my missus tell Lincoln that we wants land. This very land that is rich with the sweat of the face and the blood of the back. We could have been buy all we want, but they make the lots too big and cut we out. The word come from Mass Link himself that we take out claims and hold on to 'em and plant 'em, and he will see that we get 'em, every man 10 or 20 acre. We too glad. We stake out a list, but before the time for plant, these commissionaries sell to the white folks all the best land. Where Lincoln?" In early 1865, General William T. Sherman held a conference in Savannah, Georgia, with 20 Negro ministers and church officials, mostly former slaves, at which one of them expressed their need. "The way we can best take care of ourselves is to have land and till it by our labor." 4 days later, Sherman issued Special Field Order No. 15, designating the entire southern coastline, 30 miles inland, for exclusive Negro settlement. Freedmen could settle there, taking no more than 40 acres per family. By June 1865, 40,000 freedmen had moved on to new farms in this area. But President Andrew Johnson, in August of 1865, restored this land to the Confederate owners, and the freedmen were forced off, some at bayonet point. Ex-slave Thomas Hall told the Federal Writers Project, "Lincoln got the praise for freeing us, but did he do it? He gave us freedom without giving us any chance to live to ourselves. And we still had to depend on the southern white man for work, food, and clothing. And he held us out of necessity and went in a state of servitude, but little better than slavery." The American government had set out to fight the slave states in 1861, not to end slavery, but to retain the enormous national territory and market and resources. Yet, victory required a crusade, and the momentum of that crusade brought new forces into national politics. More blacks determined to make their freedom mean something, more whites, whether freedmen's bureau officials or teachers in the Sea Islands or carpetbaggers with various mixtures of humanitarianism and personal ambition, concerned with racial equality. There was also the powerful interest of the Republican Party in maintaining control over the national government, with the prospect of Southern black votes to accomplish this. Northern businessmen, seeing Republican policies as beneficial to them, went along for a while. The result was that brief period after the Civil War, in which Southern Negroes voted, elected blacks to state legislatures and to Congress, introduced free and racially mixed public education to the South. A legal framework was constructed. The 13th Amendment outlawed slavery. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. The 14th Amendment repudiated the pre-war Dred Scott decision by declaring that all persons born or naturalized in the United States were citizens. It also seemed to make a powerful statement for racial equality, severely limiting states' rights. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. The 15th Amendment said, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude." Congress passed a number of laws in the late 1860s and early 1870s in the same spirit, laws making it a crime to deprive Negroes of their rights, requiring federal officials to enforce those rights, giving Negroes the right to enter contracts and buy property without discrimination. And in 1875, a Civil Rights Act outlawed the exclusion of Negroes from hotels, theaters, railroads, and other public accommodations. With these laws, with the Union Army in the South as protection, and a civilian army of officials in the Freedmen's Bureau to help them, Southern Negroes came forward, voted, formed political organizations, and expressed themselves forcefully on issues important to them. They were hampered in this for several years by Andrew Johnson, vice president under Lincoln, who became president when Lincoln was assassinated at the close of the war. Johnson vetoed bills to help Negroes. He made it easy for Confederate states to come back into the Union without guaranteeing equal rights to blacks. During his presidency, these returned Southern states enacted black codes, which made the freed slaves like serfs, still working the plantations. For instance, Mississippi in 1865 made it illegal for freedmen to rent or lease farmland and provided for them to work under labor contracts, which they could not break under penalty of prison. It also provided that the courts could assign black children under 18 who had no parents or whose parents were poor to forced labor called apprenticeships, with punishment for runaways. Andrew Johnson clashed with senators and congressmen who, in some cases for reasons of justice, in others out of political calculation, supported equal rights and voting for the freedmen. These members of Congress succeeded in impeaching Johnson in 1868, using as an excuse that he had violated some minor statute, but the Senate fell one vote short of the two-thirds required to remove him from office. In the presidential election of that year, Republican Ulysses Grant was elected, winning 300,000 votes, with 700,000 Negroes voting, and so Johnson was out as an obstacle. Now the Southern states could come back into the Union only by approving the new constitutional amendments. Whatever Northern politicians were doing to help their cause, Southern blacks were determined to make the most of their freedom, in spite of their lack of land and resources. A study of blacks in Alabama in the first years after the war by historian Peter Colchin finds that they began immediately asserting their independence of whites, forming their own churches, becoming politically active, strengthening their family ties, trying to educate their children. Colchin disagrees with the contention of some historians that slavery had created a Sambo mentality of submission among blacks. As soon as they were free, these supposedly dependent, childlike Negroes began acting like independent men and women. Negroes were now elected to Southern state legislatures although in these they were a minority, except in the lower house of the South Carolina legislature. A great propaganda campaign was undertaken north and south, one which lasted well into the 20th century in the history textbooks of American schools, to show that blacks were inept, lazy, corrupt, and ruinous to the governments of the South when they were in office. Undoubtedly, there was corruption, but one could hardly claim that blacks had invented political conniving, especially in the bizarre climate of financial finagling North and South after the Civil War. It was true that the public debt of South Carolina, $7 million in 1865, went up to $29 million in 1873. But the new legislature introduced free public schools for the first time into the state. Not only were 70,000 Negro children going to school by 1876, where none had gone before, but 50,000 white children were going to school where only 20,000 had attended in 1860. Black voting in the period after 1869 resulted in two Negro members of the U.S. Senate, Hiram Revels and Blanche Bruce, both from Mississippi, and 20 congressmen, including 8 from South Carolina, 4 from North Carolina, 3 from Alabama, and 1 each from the other former Confederate states. This list would dwindle rapidly after 1876, the last black left Congress in 1901. A Columbia University scholar of the 20th century, John Burgess, referred to black Reconstruction as follows. In place of government by the most intelligent and virtuous part of the people for the benefit of the governed, here was government by the most ignorant and vicious part of the population. A black skin means membership in a race of men which has never of itself succeeded in subjecting passion to reason, has never, therefore, created civilization of any kind. One has to measure against those words the black leaders in the post-war South. For instance, Henry McNeil Turner, who had escaped from peonage on a South Carolina plantation at the age of 15, taught himself to read and write, read law books while a messenger in a lawyer's office in Baltimore, and medical books while a handyman in a Baltimore medical school, served as chaplain to a Negro regiment, and then was elected to the first post-war legislature of Georgia. In 1868, the Georgia legislature voted to expel all its Negro members, 2 senators, 25 representatives, and Turner spoke to the Georgia House of Representatives. A black woman graduate student at Atlanta University later brought his speech to light. Mr. Speaker, I wish the members of this House to understand the position that I take. I hold that I am a member of this body. Therefore, sir, I shall neither fawn or cringe before any party, nor stoop to beg them for my rights. I am here to demand my rights and to hurl thunderbolts at the men who would dare to cross the threshold of my manhood. The scene presented in this House today is one unparalleled in the history of the world. Never in the history of the world has a man been arraigned before a body clothed with legislative, judicial, or executive functions, charged with the offense of being of a darker hue than his fellow men. It has remained for the state of Georgia, in the very heart of the 19th century, to call a man before the bar and there charge him with an act for which he is no more responsible than for the head which he carries upon his shoulders. The Anglo-Saxon race, sir, is a most surprising one. I was not aware that there was in the character of that race so much cowardice or so much pusillanimity. I tell you, sir, that this is a question which will not die today. This event shall be remembered by posterity for ages yet to come, and while the sun shall continue to climb the hills of heaven. We are told that if black men want to speak, they must speak through white trumpets. If black men want their sentiments expressed, they must be adulterated and sent through white messengers who will quibble and equivocate and evade as rapidly as the pendulum of a clock. The great question, sir, is this. Am I a man? If I am such, I claim the rights of a man. Why, sir, though we are not white, we have accomplished much. We have pioneered civilization here. We have built up your country. We have worked in your fields and garnered your harvests for 250 years. And what do we ask of you in return? Do we ask you for compensation for the sweat our fathers bore for you, for the tears you have caused, and the hearts you have broken, and the lives you have curtailed, and the blood you have spilled? Do we ask retaliation? We ask it not. We are willing to let the dead past bury its dead. But we ask you now for our rights. As black children went to school, they were encouraged by teachers, black and white, to express themselves freely, sometimes in catechism style. The records of a school in Louisville, Kentucky. Teacher. Now, children, you don't think white people are any better than you because they have straight hair and white faces. Students. No, sir. Teacher. No, they are no better, but they are different. They possess great power. They form this great government. They control this vast country. Now, what makes them different from you? Students. Money. Teacher. Yes, but what enabled them to obtain it? How did they get money? Students. Got it off us. Stole it off we all. Black women helped rebuild the post-war South. Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, born free in Baltimore, self-supporting from the age of 13, working as a nursemaid, later as an abolitionist lecturer, reader of her own poetry, spoke all through the Southern states after the war. She was a feminist, participant in the 1866 Women's Rights Convention, and founder of the National Association of Colored Women. In the 1890s, she wrote the first novel published by a black woman, Iola Leroy, or Shadows Uplifted. In 1878, she described what she had seen and heard recently in the South. An acquaintance of mine who lives in South Carolina and has been engaged in mission work reports that in supporting the family, women are the mainstay, that two-thirds of the truck gardening is done by them in South Carolina, that in the city they are more industrious than the men. When the men lose their work through their political affiliations, the women stand by them and say, "Stand by your principles." Through all the struggles to gain equal rights for blacks, certain black women spoke out on their special situation. Sojourner Truth, at a meeting of the American Equal Rights Association, said, "There is a great stir about colored men getting their rights, but not a word about the colored women. And if colored men get their rights and not colored women theirs, you see the colored men will be masters over the women, and it will be just as bad as it was before. So I am for keeping the thing going while things are stirring, because if we wait till it is still, it'll take a great while to get it going again. I am above 80 years old. It is about time for me to be going. I have been 40 years a slave and 40 years free, and would be here 40 years more to have equal rights for all. I suppose I am kept here because something remains for me to do. I suppose I am yet to help break the chain. I have done a great deal of work, as much as a man, but did not get so much pay. I used to work in the field and bind grain, keeping with the cradler, but men doing no more got twice as much pay. I suppose I am about the only colored woman that goes about to speak for the rights of the colored women. I want to keep things stirring now that the ice is cracked." The constitutional amendments were passed. the laws for racial equality were passed, and the black man began to vote and hold office. But so long as the Negro remained dependent on privileged whites for work, for the necessities of life, his vote could be bought or taken away by threat of force. Thus, laws calling for equal treatment became meaningless. While Union troops, including colored troops, remained in the South, this process was delayed, but the balance of military powers began to change. The Southern white oligarchy used its economic power to organize the Ku Klux Klan and other terrorist groups. Northern politicians began to weigh the advantage of the political support of impoverished blacks, maintained in voting and office only by force, against the more stable situation of a South returned to white supremacy, accepting Republican dominance and business legislation. It was only a matter of time before blacks would be reduced once again to conditions not far from slavery. Violence began almost immediately with the end of the war. In Memphis, Tennessee, in May of 1866, whites on a rampage of murder killed 46 Negroes, most of them veterans of the Union Army, as well as two white sympathizers. 5 Negro women were raped. 90 homes, 12 schools, and 4 churches were burned. In New Orleans in the summer of 1866, another riot against blacks killed 35 Negroes and 3 whites. Mrs. Sarah Song testified before a congressional investigating committee. "Have you been a slave?"
"I have been a slave."
"What did you see of the rioting?"
"I saw them kill my husband. It was on a Tuesday night between 10 and 11 o'clock. He was shot in the head while he was in bed sick. There were between 20 and 30 men. They came into the room. Then one stepped back and shot him. He was not a yard from him. He put the pistol to his head and shot him 3 times. Then one of them kicked him, and another shot him again when he was down. He never spoke after he fell. They then went running right off and did not come back again."
The violence mounted through the late 1860s and early 1870s as the Ku Klux Klan organized raids, lynchings, beatings, burnings. For Kentucky alone, between 1867 and 1871, the National Archives lists 116 acts of violence. A sampling. Number 1. A mob visited Harrodsburg in Mercer County to take from jail a man named Robertson, November 14, 1867. Number 5. Sam Davis, hung by a mob in Harrodsburg, May 28, 1868. Number 6, William Pierce, hung by a mob in Christian, July 12, 1868. Number 7, George Roger, hung by a mob in Bradfordville, Martin County, July 11, 1868. Number 10, Silas Woodford, age 60, badly beaten by disguised mob. 109. Negro killed by Ku Klux Klan in Hay County, January 14, 1871. A Negro blacksmith named Charles Caldwell, born a slave, later elected to the Mississippi Senate, and known as a notorious and turbulent Negro by whites, was shot at by the son of a white Mississippi judge in 1868. Caldwell fired back and killed the man. Tried by an all-white jury, he argued self-defense and was acquitted, the first Negro to kill a white in Mississippi and go free after trial. But on Christmas Day, 1875, Caldwell was shot to death by a white gang. It was a sign. The old white rulers were taking back political power in Mississippi and everywhere else in the South. As white violence rose in the 1870s, the national government, even under President Grant, became less enthusiastic about defending blacks and certainly not prepared to arm them. The Supreme Court played its gyroscopic role of pulling the other branches of government back to more conservative directions when they went too far. It began interpreting the 14th Amendment, passed presumably for racial equality, in a way that made it impotent for this purpose. In 1883, the Civil Rights Act of 1875